this week's 51%, a woman uses comedy to espouse feminism.
We need to use the word feminism because we just need it now. Things aren't equal.
Another comedian comes at the art a bit differently, and women veterans are leading the way when it comes to going into business for themselves. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I've no Grammy, no rewards. I've no Tony Awards. I'm constantly replaced by Britney Spears. Britney Spears. Whatever happened to my show? I won the hit.
Gibson calls herself a Southern loudmouth. She's the creator of the long-running Emmy-nominated Game of Thrones web series, a parody of the popular Game of Thrones, and half of the Throwing Shade podcast. Gibson has now authored her debut book of comedic essays entitled Feminasty, The Complicated Woman's Guide to Surviving the Patriarchy Without Drinking Herself to Death. Gibson's aim is to uplift women at every opportunity, and she isn't afraid to shed light on the hidden rules that make life as a woman unnecessarily difficult. And in Feminasty, she deconstructs these rules in a way described as bold, provocative, and hilarious. I asked her why she wrote the book.
Well, I've been talking about feminist issues using the lens of comedy for almost 10 years now, and I just started getting really frustrated with the books that I was reading on feminism because I felt like they were very much coming from a really, you know, academic place, which I can appreciate. But for someone like me who grew up in the South and didn't really, and came to feminism very late in life, I wanted to write something that was a little more accessible for people who weren't, you know, binging on feminist propaganda all the time.
So late in life is subjective. What is it for you, and how did you come to it?
Well, I had a friend who gave me a copy of Susan Faludi's Backlash my second year of college. And that kind of tipped me over. I'd always been a light feminist, but I did a lot of stuff in my life that I look back at and I think were very much an expression of internalized sexism. And I didn't really realize I was doing those things until I started reading Backlash and seeing just the small ways that women are marginalized. That was the tipping point for me. And then I just kind of got addicted to knowing more. And now here's where I am today. But even that book, it's, you know, it was given to me by a friend. She was vouching for it. She was saying, you need to read it. Here are all the reasons why. So if you don't have a friend like that and you don't have some sort of entrance to figuring out how you're marginalized, I wanted to write a book that was easy. Easier for women to see these things without getting overwhelmed by how sad they are. And by they, I mean the issues. When you are an intellectual and you're in feminism and you're trying to change things, it is really, really hard to take a step back and try to find the humor in it because it affects you personally. It is very personal. It's a personal attack on a lot of things that we should have the rights to, our body, autonomy, decisions, money, power, all of these things. So I think a lot of people's reaction to things that are overwhelming is pretend it's not happening or get really angry about it and kind of get overwhelmed by that anger or not really know what to do about it. I'm trying to ride the line in the middle where you can know about these things and yes, they're sad, but let's figure out a way to punch up, to make fun of the people who are doing this to us so that we can actually take their power away and change things.
So what is your hope that readers take from your book?
Well, I hope people will take away that they have the power to change things and it doesn't need to seem as overwhelming as the news or, you know, women and their family might make it out to be. It is very sad and I think there's power in acknowledging that, but I don't think it should be a situation where we let the sadness debilitate us from changing it.
So what was the tipping point for you? I mean, we're living under a patriarchy, nothing new there. So what's different lately, need I ask? And how does that warrant an injection of comedy to result in some sort of change? I mean, why now? Why not 5 or 10 years ago?
Well, look, I've been covering women's issues for a long time through the Obama administration when I think everyone thought, oh, everything's fine. But I was seeing on a state level how abortion rights were getting attacked. And abortion in many states, because of trap laws, was becoming essentially illegal. And so I've been kind of seeing this storm, this like small storm that was brewing. And I was even worried when during Hillary Clinton's campaign, I was worried that people were going to take their internalized misogyny and their straight up misogyny and not vote for her because she is a woman. And that is definitely what happened with men in my family who I know wouldn't vote for her. And so I think that for me has been a tipping point of like, okay, we actually have to change this and it has to be us. And I think, well, I know other women feel the same way because we're seeing it in women running for office and getting nominated, getting the nomination and having a chance to be in a position of power to change things. It's really exciting. And I don't think it would have happened if Trump hadn't been president.
A number of people have pointed out that that's a positive outcome of the presidency. And, you know, we are seeing a lot of women, a record number, in fact, of women running for office. There have been primaries in several states and women winning their primaries in some cases. And interestingly, very left-leaning women in some cases, in some unlikely places. So very interesting phenomena going on in our country.
Well, in Texas, which is where I'm from, we have a Democratic nominee who is a Mexican-American lesbian. I just never knew Texas had it in her, but I'm so excited. It fills me with hope, to be honest. During the Obama administration, I was like, there's going to be a backlash and it's going to be ugly. People are going to be mad at this progress and they're not going to like that they're seeing people who don't look like them in charge. And it's going to be really ugly. And unfortunately, America has to do a scorched earth kind of screwing things up for a long period of time before we fix anything. But I feel like we are in the fixing things era. I mean, we'll see in November.
Yes, we will. I was reading a bit of your book, and there was something in there that I thought was kind of interesting. And you started a part saying, girls are the new women. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Well, I get really frustrated when adult women are referred to as girls, and there's all these labels of girls like Skinny Girl Margarita, Girls Night Out. A lot of book titles now have girl in the title, even though the character is usually a 30-year-old woman who oftentimes ends up dead. But it was just this trend of taking power away by using this kind of infantile term. And I don't think any man would stand for it. But there's this attachment of youth and like, oh, you have your whole life ahead of you if you're a girl, even if you're a 40-year-old woman. And it just is, it's powerless in a way, or it impedes power by using the word. I think woman is a fantastic word. We used it a bunch in the 70s. I'm ready for it to make a comeback. The connotation is, I'm using this label because I want you to know that I'm above you. So when I call you a girl, I want you to know I'm putting you in that's your status. But here, I don't have a problem with it. Like, if I'm with my friend and I call her girl, like, I don't have a problem with that. It's the use of it overall as a label for adult women.
I was hoping you could point to some more things in your book that you obviously deliver comedically, but there's something serious underlying it all.
Well, I really was excited to write about cosmetics because I love makeup. I was, you know, raised in the South. We like to look like clowns or drag queen adjacent. So I love makeup. I understand it's a tool of the patriarchy to make us fit this kind of male gaze ideal. But I love it. I love it. And I started researching how many of the cosmetic companies were run by men, and they all are. So I wanted to dismantle that. I wanted women to see who's getting their money, who they're making rich. Men who probably couldn't tell you the difference between concealer and a highlighter, and I want to take their money away. I do not want them to make money off of this thing that is so female-centric. I would wish for any woman in the world to be a millionaire off mascara, but I don't want some straight guy who lives in Italy to be sitting on a yacht off of my concealer money.
So have you found any?
Yeah, there's a lot of great places up and coming, and they don't sell to big cosmetic companies. We're still good, and I hate to admit it, but Kylie Jenner is one of them. She's 100% female-owned and operated, so you should feel half guilty when you buy her lip kits.
So what kind of sexism do you come across?
Well, I mean, I'm in entertainment. I write about feminism in a comedic way, but I also had a TV show and, you know, pitch movies, and it's all sexist. It's all sexist. It's people telling me time and time again they don't want to see, oh, we don't want to see a TV show with a 30-year-old protagonist. Oh, does she have to be that old? I get that a lot, that 30 is old. And all the people at the top are men, and they're all dictating the stories. Actually, in my book, I write about May-December romances because my parents are a May-December romance, and I always had this idea growing up that they were, like, the normal, the thing that everybody does. And when I started researching it, I realized that, oh, like, only a small percentage of the population is in a May-December romance, but you can look at, I can tell you a million movies that depict it without it being part of the story, just like, of course this old man's dating this young woman. And that's a great example of sexism that women in Hollywood have to deal with, trying to get different stories on the screen to be an example of a normal age-appropriate relationship. Now, I'm not saying, like, there's not a healthy May-December romance out there, but I'm really tired of seeing guys, AARP age guys, making out with early 30s women. I don't want to see another one. So, you know, my fight inside Hollywood is to write as many stories as I can, try to get them made so that we can change the narrative.
So given you're out in LA, I wanted to know what you thought of the Me Too movement, considering it pretty much started with Harvey Weinstein.
I think it's great. I think we needed it. We've needed it for a long time. I'm so excited it's happening. Let me give you a great example of what Me Too has done for me personally that I don't think most people would think of as a positive outcome from the movement. But I had a friend who I saw on Saturday. We were having a long talk, and we were talking about Me Too. And he said, I want to apologize to you. I feel like our friendship was started in a really, like, negative way, and I used to be kind of cruel to you with the way we used to joke around, and I'm really sorry about that. And we just talked for a long time, and then I realized, like, yeah, and then I was mirroring that back to you, and it was really bad, and we built this foundation of awfulness, and we just apologized to each other, and it was great. And we would have never had that conversation if it weren't for Me Too. We would have just brushed it under the rug. Oh, well, that's the thing that happened, whatever. That kind of stuff is happening all over town in different ways. So I don't think it's not just like, oh, we hear all these stories of women and the sexual assault that they've experienced at work, or the harassment they've dealt with at work, or in different situations. It's branching out into all these, like, really amazing healing moments, and I'm really glad for it.
Yeah, I've heard a few anecdotes and experienced some myself in that way, where there's just this new consciousness among some men about what's acceptable and what's unacceptable, what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. So, you know, this is the way forward. It is, right? We hope. And to the point of moving forward, what else in your book?
Well, I also talk about, so I've had a double mastectomy. I am a BRCA 2 carrier. And so I talk a lot about breast cancer awareness and where that money goes and how much help we women who have breast cancer actually need versus what they're getting. That's a subject near and dear to me. I've lost a lot of family members from breast cancer, and I think it should be illegal to raise the money they're raising while women struggle to fight the disease.
Who do you think is a good role model in comedy or entertainment?
Oh, interesting. Okay. Who do I think in entertainment is a great role model? Well, I think, Amy Schumer's a pretty great feminist. I mean, everyone has, like, moments, but I think she's pretty great. You know, my friend Nikki Glaser's a staunch feminist. Beyonce's doing the best job right now. You know, I grew up listening to Beyonce. I'm from Houston. We're the same age. And I watched her trajectory, and I just think I'm so impressed and excited that she's using her platform to make people think.
What about a disservice?
There's a couple of actresses who call themselves humanists and kind of dance around feminism, like we don't really need feminism. And I think that's really dangerous. I think using the word humanist is skirting the issue that we need to separate. We need to use the word feminism because we just need it now. Things aren't equal. And when things are equal, we can use the term humanist. We can be like, I'm for all humans. But until then, when you have women and you know, women on the bottom of the scale, and then, you know, different races of women even below that. And you've got all these women suffering and trying to survive and have rights and just be, just exist. We have to delineate.
Anything else you'd like to point out, Erin?
So I tried really hard to make this book intersectional. And for those of you who may be unfamiliar with that, there's a problem in this country with white feminism where white women are very concerned about their issues, but can't see the myriad of ways that sexism hurts and harms women of color and trans women. And so I think it's important with this book, because I didn't have time to like truly talk about all the issues that I want to talk about, I tried every single chapter to parse out how these issues affect women of color differently. And I think it's important that when we're looking at the things we need to change in this country, that we as women think about that and think about how our experience is not her experience and her experience isn't our experience. And we have to take all those lessons and listen to everybody and try to fix this country and its laws so that everyone wins.
That was Erin Gibson. Her debut book is Feminasty: The Complicated Woman's Guide to Surviving the Patriarchy Without Drinking Herself to Death. Maggie Farris is a Minnesota comedian. She's produced two CDs and co-host Magnotronic, a weekly comedy podcast. KFAI's Dixie Trichel spoke with Farris about what she ferrets out as funny.
I have been doing stand-up for 18 years.
Let's make a big round of applause for Maggie Farris!
How's it going, guys?
I feel like my stand-up is now an adult. I sure do love it, and I just keep doing it. My sister was actually a waitress down at Acme Comedy Club in Minneapolis. I used to just go down there and hang out. I'd watch and think, oh, I could do that. Of course, you do it, and it is not at all what you think it is. It takes a long time to figure out what's funny, what works, what doesn't work. I mean, everything that you think is funny and is going to work never works. But, that's not going to be funny. I'd just try it, and then that would work. So I talk about all kinds of stuff. You know, I think when you present as kind of a butch, masculine-looking woman, it's hard to not address it or know, you know. A lot of times people don't know, though. They think I'm just a farmer's wife.
My name is Maggie. I am not a paper boy. I am just an adorable lesbian. Does anyone care? Good. Let's move on.
The Saints, they had a contest to be their new public address announcer. Boy, I think this was like 2001 or something. And you watch silly baseball clips and you had to just narrate and talk about them. And so me and another guy won. In 2013, the Advocate magazine had a national contest search for the next funniest queer comedian. And they had the finals in Chicago. I think there was like 10 of us in the finals, and I won that as well.
So I became an over-the-road truck driver because that is one of four career choices they give you as a lesbian. I don't know if you know. Yeah. It goes truck driver, number one. Number two, gym teacher. Oh, any age, it doesn't matter. It's right on through college, really.
In the last few years, I've been doing a lot of colleges. I also do a ton of shows in town. It's really fun with all the breweries opening up. They all have comedy rooms, and it feels like there's kind of a resurgence of comedy.
This guy pipes up. He's like, yeah, that's because there's too much testosterone in the air. What kind of pizza are you ordering, buddy? Really? And if you're getting testosterone on your half, maybe I could get estrogen chovies on my half? Anyone is
going to
deliver this pizza.
Sisyphus Brewery. I do a New Year's Eve show there, and it's always been really fun, and I do a ton of silly things like glittery balls drop from the ceiling, and we have booby prizes and fun stuff like that. Sisyphus is one of my most favorite rooms to work at. It's an intimate room, probably 80 people, 80, 90 people. They pack them in just right. My philosophy on comedy is whoever you are, whatever you believe, you've been out working hard all week and you deserve to relax and laugh a little.
Thank you so much. I've been Maggie Ferris. Enjoy the rest of your night.
That was Minnesota comedian Maggie Ferris speaking with KFAI's Dixie Trykle. Around the country, state governments and other agencies are trying to promote entrepreneurship among military veterans. Former service members are slightly more likely to go into business for themselves compared with their civilian counterparts, and women veterans are leading the way. Bobby O'Brien reports from Tampa, Florida.
These are all green Malayan right here we're looking at.
Justin Duay is walking through his coconut groves in Homestead, Florida. The 28-year-old Army linguist and cyber specialist is transitioning into civilian life. That's why he bought the 5-acre Coco Rico Farms, sight unseen.
I farmed before in Texas, but it was all vegetable farming, nothing like this. But I saw the potential of money that, you know, they were growing fruit and that they, you know, that it was a good investment.
That was less than a year ago. Duay admits he knew nothing about coconuts at the time. But just like when he learned Farsi in 47 weeks in the Army, Duay sees the challenge. And his military experience is helping him in other ways. He happened to cross paths with a veteran in the food business who was looking for a fresh coconut supplier. As two Army men, they bonded instantly.
And that's part of the military mindset. You see each other and you pick up your battle buddy and they pick you up and you both have a vision, a goal, and you keep on moving forward.
So Duay and Alex Hill became business battle buddies, not partners, but supplier and vendor. Hill, who was in the Army Airborne, sells fresh coconut water to tourists along the beach. He says it's not the first time he's done business with other people who've been in the military.
You know, they have a similar work ethic as you, you know, and they also uphold those similar values that you have. It's hard to find people that have those same values that are outside of the military.
About 2.5 million veterans own businesses. According to the Syracuse University Institute for Veterans and Military Families, veterans own 13% to 15% of small businesses, though they're only 8% of the population. And the Institute's Misty Stutzman says female veterans in particular are driving the trend.
Women veteran entrepreneurship has grown over 300% since 2007. Which is insane. But I think that, you know, as you look at these entrepreneurs, not only is this the startups great, but they're out earning their civilian counterparts.
That success record among veteran-owned startups has attracted the attention of states, universities, and other agencies. They've launched hundreds of programs around the country in the past few years designed to help veterans get their businesses off the ground.
The biggest thing that shows the growth of entrepreneurship and the growth of small business and how important it is the fact that communities are really investing in these programs to make sure that the next generation of entrepreneurs are supported.
Welcome to the Veterans Florida Battle of the Pitches.
This is one popular feature of many entrepreneurship programs. Welcome to the state of Florida's first ever Battle of the Pitches, where veteran entrepreneurs competed for more than $20,000 in cash from the state government.
Second place goes to Alex Hill of Florida Coconuts.
Alex Hill's company, Florida Coconuts, took second prize. He lost out to a National Guardsman with a specialized motor company. But Hill's prize came at a good time. A drop in the coconut supply and a seasonal dip in tourism has hurt his business. So he's pursuing a new entrepreneurial idea. Hill is trying to design a coconut opener, better than his Army-issued axe. I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1523.